Welcome back to Raising Rare. We are in our fifth season talking about the joys, challenges, and surprises of raising children with a rare disease. Our co-hosts, Sanath Ramesh and Brittany Ratke, will keep you updated on their kiddos. And we hope our lineup of guests will give you new insights and hope. My name is Kevin Fryert. Welcome back to Raising Rare. Today we're talking to Stacy Lloyd. She has a disease called von Hippel-Landau disease. And I met her when she was working at Savvy Co-op at a conference somewhere, and now she's working with the American Medical Association, looking at health tech and other ideas like that. I need to apologize once again. Brittany's going through a bad streak here. They're back in the hospital with Everly with an infection. So hopefully we'll have her back next week. So Sanath, how's Raghav doing in this flu season?
He was holding up okay until this morning when his sleep got messed up. So I'm assuming he's coming down with something. But you know, as long as it's nothing serious, we're okay with it. Well, to be seen.
So, Stacy, can you introduce yourself and tell us a little more about you?
Of course, and thank you so much for having me. So, as you mentioned, I'm a rare disease patient myself, living with VHL, which is short for von Hippel-Lindau disease. I was officially diagnosed at the age of 13, but had what I call my first episode at the age of 10. Because of my own healthcare experiences, I started getting into patient advocacy in my late 20s, early 30s. And I joined the board at the VHL Alliance, which is the nonprofit dedicated to supporting the VHL community, and also became a board-certified patient advocate as well. I also work in the healthcare industry as my full-time job. I'm currently the Director of Digital Health and Operations at the American Medical Association, and really just enjoy having the opportunity to share my patient perspective across my work there. And then the first part of my career I spent in the health system environment across various areas of finance and operations. And as you mentioned, I had the opportunity to meet you, Kevin, at when I was working at a startup called Savvy Cooperative, they help to get healthcare organizations and companies across the industry the patient insights that they need to make better solutions, treatments, and programs. I often joke I should have gotten a hobby outside of healthcare because I'm sure we all know it can be a little bit exhausting, but I think these experiences we have in the rare disease community really drive us in the direction that we take because of the passion that many of us have to try and make a difference. So again, thanks for having me today and really looking forward to the conversation.
Thanks for joining us. I'm really excited to have you here. I think as parents and patients who have experience in the healthcare system, it's hard to have hobbies outside of the system. You know, it's almost like a cult, right? You get into the cult, you don't ever get out of it. But I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. But I'm sure you know the journey to get to here wasn't as straightforward. So could you maybe talk about what the disease is and how you were diagnosed, especially in the early stages?
Yeah. So VHL is a rare genetic disease. Approximately 80% of individuals that have VHL have an affected parent. I'm in that camp. And about 20% are de novo, meaning first in family. Fun fact, everyone has a VHL gene. When you have the VHL disease, that means it's either mutated or deleted completely. And what that gene does for our bodies is suppress tumors. So when it's messed up or missing, we aren't having that tumor suppression happen. So VHL patients can grow tumors in up to 10 different areas of the body. So that's a little bit about VHL itself. My journey, if you will. I was officially diagnosed at 13, like I mentioned, but at the age of 10, I ended up having a seizure one summer morning. They lifelighted me to Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh with a blood pressure of 240 over 120. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. They thought maybe I hit my head when I had a seizure. You know, they were scanning me and things and really couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. My poor grandfather was with me at the hospital because he babysat me in the summer. And there, he said, well, her aunt had this weird tumor on her adrenal gland when she was 16. And it was like this light bulb moment in the emergency room. They looked at my adrenals and found what's called a pheochromocytoma. So it's a tumor on the adrenal gland, and immediately knew that was what was going on. So obviously got that in addition to another tumor called a paraganglioma between my aorta and my vena cava and my abdomen, removed at the age of 10. And then through routine ultrasound a couple of years later, they actually found another tumor. Went in. I wasn't symptomatic. They went in, removed it. I actually came out of surgery symptomatic, and they scanned my whole body and found metastasis to the bone and sent us to the National Institute of Health because they were basically like, we don't know what to do with you. So that was really kind of the impetus for all of our genetic testing. And when we as a family, when myself and other members of my family were officially diagnosed with VHL at that point in time.
Wow. It sounds like a very scary journey, and you've obviously gone through it bravely. And I'm sure your parents and your family members have had, you know, sort of been the biggest care of their life, right? So from your perspective, what do you remember having gone through that period without an answer? Like what was the biggest questions in your head, especially as a kid?
Yeah, that's interesting because like when they first took the tumors out, when I was 10, we kind of just thought it was like a one and done thing, right? So we weren't really thinking about it all that much post that really scary initial scenario. And then when we were sent to the NIH, that was a lot to take in as a kid. I remember actually seeing a physician down there, and we were down there for the week. That's kind of how it goes when you go to the NIH. You spend a whole week, you do all your testing, and you get kind of a little meeting with the doctors at the end of the week, and you go home and you come back when you need to. But I remember one of the first times down there, there was like a school dance. I was like, you know, 13 at the time, and there was a school dance on Friday, and I'm like, are we going to be back in time? And the doctor basically said, you know, you're a really sick kid and this is all you need to focus on right now. And that's really scary, right? And even before that, I don't even know that my mom had told me this, but she had dealt with it. The doctor at UPMC in Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh said, you know, you're probably not going to see her be able to walk by the time she goes to dances later, you know, prom. And she's probably never going to drive a car. And kind of like that was like the tone set really early in the diagnosis that I received, especially with the bone mets. So it was definitely a scary time. And I think even, you know, through a lot of my childhood and teenage years, kind of like my mom wanted to keep me in this bubble. And, you know, I'm also an only child, so layer that on. And I was just kind of like the center of the universe. And the most important thing was, you know, making sure that I was getting the care that I needed. So definitely a scary time. It was an interesting bonding experience for our family because we all did go to the NIH for a while to receive our care and do our annual like surveillance and maintenance and things. So it was kind of like a nice meeting place for us because my aunt lives out in California. So she would travel in and my other aunt, my mom and I would go down and we would have all of our testing together. So it was kind of like a little bit of family bonding, which was nice. But ultimately, you know, we ended up seeking care back in our individual cities and kind of all handle it a little bit different.
Thanks for covering that. I mean, my wife and I joke that every time my son gets sick and admitted to the hospital, it's our date night. as challenging it is. Yeah, exactly. As challenging it is, as it is, we take it in stride and do what the best we can.
go to that nice romantic hospital cafeteria or vending machines.
Usually the vending machines, because cafeterias are close by the time we reach the hospital.
So what is the impact on your life now, Stacey?
Yeah, you know, I'm pretty fortunate to have lived and continue to still live a really normal life. I often joke that I should go back to the NIH and tell that physician, like, look at me now. That was, like, very harsh towards me initially because, you know, I really didn't think that I would be here, you know, at this point in time, or at least, you know, living the life that I live. But right now I do annual surveillance for the tumors that I do have. I still have those bone mets. They're not operable, so they kind of just sit there and hang out and we watch them. They haven't affected me yet. So again, I feel really fortunate. But yeah, I do that annual surveillance, which is basically a lot of either MRIs or CT scans. We do an eye exam because you can grow tumors in the retina, and then have annual blood work as well. Physically, I feel very good. I'm active. I lead a normal life. I think what's super challenging for me, but I think I hear it a lot across our VHL community too, is just living and dealing with that unknown. We talk a lot about it in our community, but scanxiety is kind of like a thing leading up to testing each year, however that frequency is for patients, right? It's kind of like what's going to show up. And you don't always have symptoms for these tumors. So, you know, that might be the first time you find something or hear about something new. So it's definitely a scary thing. And so like the mental kind of behavioral health aspect of care has really become super, super important across our community. And, you know, it's something like I like to check myself too, just to make sure I'm feeling good and do things that, you know, can take your mind off of what the unknown is.
Is there a treatment for this disease?
Great question. Up until September of 2021, the only real treatment option was surgical removal of the tumors, if they were able to be surgically removed. Like I said, the ones on my bones are not operable, so it's not an option. Honestly, the burden from having to have so many surgeries on a lot of VHL patients is a huge concern. And in many cases, that kind of is the, you know, cause of bigger problems or even people passing away because of that disease burden of the surgeries that it takes. So again, up until that September 2021 timeframe, surgical removal was the only real option, if it was an option. And it's crazy, like I met people that have had like 30 plus brain surgeries. Like I can't even imagine going through something like that. So in September of 2021, the FDA approved a drug called Welireg, and it is the first kind of pharmaceutical drug treatment available for VHL patients. It actually was initially studied specific to renal cell carcinoma, which is a type of tumor and condition that is aligned with VHL. So we saw a lot of great progress for those patients across our community that have kidney tumors and kidney cancer. But we also, the clinical trials also tracked patients that had other types of tumors in addition to those kidney tumors, right? So a few folks had brain tumors and tumors in their eyes, and there was also shrinkage in those tumors as well. So that has become a huge kind of like beacon of hope across our community. And it is still new, and there's still a lot of like studying and things to do around the long-term impacts of being on that and things like that. But it is definitely started to kind of minimize the burden of surgical removal by kind of shrinking those tumors and allowing physicians to kind of wait and not do the operations and things like that. So those are kind of our options right now.
Do you know if they studied whether or not that helps stop new tumors from forming?
That's a good question. I don't know that they did do that. Yeah, I don't think that was part of this, but they looked at shrinkage, and then there were a few cases that tumors completely did go away. But like I said, still new and still a lot to like look into. You know, what happens when you go off of it? Do those tumors grow, continue to grow again? Do they come back? Things like that. So definitely still a lot of research and studying to do. But it has been definitely, like I said, kind of that beacon of hope in our community.
It's incredible to have a simpler, hopefully a cheaper option, less invasive option for the community. Because the drug is approved only September 2021, I'm assuming it's not widely available for a lot of the folks. Do you have to take the treatment like every day, or is it something that you take only when your tumors get worse, and then you take it for like a brief period and then stop it?
So, you know, my understanding, and I'm personally not on it, I have kind of sat with the approach of like, don't try to like fix something that isn't broken, and I'm like in a good place. So I'm like, let's not mess with something that isn't messing with me right now. But I do think that's still an area of study too, right? Is kind of like, what is the right protocol? It is in like pill form, so it can be taken, based on kind of the clinical protocol that's agreed to or given by the doctor, right? And that's going to vary likely by the doctor, likely by potentially even the severity of the tumor, how many, you know, things like that. So I don't have a great sense. And I think that's still an area of opportunity for additional study as well in terms of like, what are those right protocols? When do you take someone off? When do you put them back on? Still, since it's so new, just still kind of being studied and really at the mercy of, but really up to that physician and clinical expertise in managing each individual's patient's care.
I want to make one remark. As we were talking, I was just looking at the price of the drug. It's about $40,000 for like a 90-day supply. That's a lot if you are trying to take the medication, you know, if you have to take it every day chronically, right? It's still not as crazy as the million-dollar gene therapies, but for a drug that you can never be off of, it's quite expensive, and I'm not sure if every insurance would cover it. So I hope there will be more treatments that are cheaper in the future.
Yeah, it's definitely expensive. I think we have seen some insurance coverage for those that have insurance. I think we have to do better in general as an industry in lowering the costs of drugs and treatments in general. But I will say a little bit of a shout out to Merck, who actually distributes the drug. They do have a really good and supportive patient financial assistance program. So we have had patients be able to seek that support as well from a financial perspective.
You may be one of our listeners who is actively trying to find treatments for your rare kiddo because no one else is. Have you ever felt like just when you thought you understood how to find and develop treatments, there's something new to learn? One more step. Imagine a place you can go to see the big picture and drill down to the details you need today. We at Salem Oaks are building that place. We are calling it the Biopharmaceutical Atlas for Discovery and Development, your self-paced guide to understanding the process of medical research and development. We call it the Atlas for short. Each month, we will deliver at least 30 minutes of bite-sized microlearning content that you can digest when it is convenient for you. We need your help to design the Atlas to meet your needs. So check us out at www.salemoaks.com/atlas. So you're very involved in the VHL community. How did that happen? How did you get involved?
Yeah, so The Alliance actually started a young adult retreat some years ago now. I have officially aged out of that. No longer am part of the young adult retreat, but they invited me to the first one and kind of just reached out to their community listserv, right, around patients that are or within that age group. I wasn't able to go. But it really started conversations with the Alliance that I wasn't having previously with their executive director. And it's a small team, right? There's only, you know, even still today, only four, I think, full-time folks that are supporting the Alliance. We're hoping to grow. I really just started having more and more conversations with that team. And later in the year, I actually attended what we call our annual family weekend, which happens each year. We coordinate it with a clinical care center that we work with, which is usually a large academic medical center. We work with, I think, around 40 across the country. Can share a little bit more about those as well. But it was hosted in Tampa at Moffitt Cancer Center. So I drug my mom with me, and we went to this annual family weekend that they had, and it's a really nice event. It's for patients and families, obviously, but the physicians, and the care team members that work at Moffitt and support VHL patients, at the Moffitt Cancer Center actually kind of present on the different manifestations of VHL, the latest research, things like that. So it's kind of like a nice program. We do a charity event on the front end on Friday, all of the programming Saturday, and then do like a run walk type of event on Sunday morning to kind of close it out. I walked away from that and said, I have to get involved. It was the first time I'd ever met anyone outside of my family. And I was about 29 at the time. First time I ever met anyone outside of my family with VHL. There are, I think, seven other members of my family with VHL, but it's different when you meet someone outside of that group that you are, you know, so familiar with. Heard new stories. Again, that was kind of the first time I had heard someone talk about having like those 30 brain surgeries. And that was just like wild to me. And I think it's very easy sometimes when you're in your own bubble to kind of just say like, why is this happening to me? Woe is me. Like, you know, really kind of get into your head that way. And that event really kind of like brought me out of that space and said, you know what, like, it's not as bad as it could be. And I also worked in healthcare, and I said, I could be supporting this community and be supporting other patients and families that maybe aren't as savvy at navigating the healthcare system or are newly diagnosed and trying to figure that out. So that was really like, I knew I could just add value, and I wanted to support the community and the group. So that's kind of how I got involved. I was on the board about 6 months later, and I'm just about to wrap up my sixth year on the board, and I'm currently chair. So a little bit about my journey getting involved.
I think this is how we grow the community, right? Like, the more people that are affected needs to get involved, because if our voice isn't heard, someone else will overwrite it, right? The doctors will say this is what the patients want and absolutely be wrong 100% of the time. So I'm so glad you were involved. Having grown up with VHL and having, you know, seen now other patients with VHL, what would you say to younger patients with VHL or young adults that have a chronic disease?
I think it is so important to start surveillance and kind of get into a routine of care and doing what you need to do at an early age and maintain it. So I'm kind of speaking to like other patients, but knowing that a lot of parents of rare disease patients also listen to this podcast, it's so important as a parent to also make that very important in your kid's life and almost make it routine for them, because it's so important then in those transitions in life of going from a child or a teenager and then you're going to potentially college and living on your own and setting up those good, healthy habits of making sure you're receiving the care that you need and managing it and you're able to, I think is just so important. And it makes me feel comfort knowing like I'm going to get that annual, you know, imaging, and I know what I need to do to take care of myself, and I know where I need to go if something happens to me. And I just think that's just so critically important to instill at a young age. Because it's just become a part of my life. Is it, you know, my favorite part of life? No, but it's a crucial part of my life, and it's just routine at this point. And I think setting that expectation early and just kind of leaning into that is super important.
That's actually very interesting, because as you were talking about this, I was contrasting my personal experience of taking care of a medically complex kid and my personal experience of taking care of me. If I were to take care of another medically complex kid, I would do just as fine, right? It's now routine. I know what to do. There are ups and downs. We will deal with it. We will get through it. But if I was to, I don't know, break a leg, or you know, a little while ago, I had something that's temporary, but it was just difficult to manage, right? Very short duration, nothing like what you're going through. But I was a baby. I was just like, I couldn't help myself, right? And you know, there's the same person can take care of an incredibly complex kid while cannot take care of me, because I've never learned to take care of myself. And so developing that attitude towards your health, taking care of you, making sure, you know, you can be taken care of by others when something goes wrong, it's incredible. And I think a lot of people wouldn't think about it because that's not their first nature anyway.
But it's so crucial, right? Because caregivers have to your point, they have to be able to take care of themselves too, because you have to be healthy and feel good to be able to kind of take on the things that you need to do as a caregiver. And we talk a lot about that in the VHL community too, because of spouses and you have sick kids and, you know, parents and things like that. It is really important, and caregivers kind of need to have that bit of attitude of taking care of themselves too. And they also have to have community. Like, they have to have other people that are in that position to kind of talk to and, you know, share stories and things like that.
So you've mentioned a couple times that other people in your family have VHL. How involved are they, and how do they manage the disease?
Yeah, I think I would say I'm the most involved and probably the most on top of my disease management as well. Maybe some of that is a product of me having it so young and, you know, getting those metastases to the bone very young. So I've always had something to manage. I think, again, everyone in my family kind of does it a little bit different. My mom has mostly been very good about it because she wanted me to be very good about it for myself. So I think that helped her adopt some of those good behaviors because it was setting an example for me, right? I have had a couple of the other family members have different surgeries and manifestations that they've had to have care for. We've had a couple of brain tumors. Funny enough, my cousin, very shortly after I had that Fio at 10, he was having similar symptoms. So they took him in and found one in him too. And still at that point, we didn't get flagged for a genetic testing yet. It took me going back in years later and then kind of got the ball rolling, even though we had three members of the family at that point that had this weird tumor. So that's kind of a little fun fact too. But I think not many other members of my family are as regimented in kind of the routine surveillance of getting all of the imaging and all of the testing. You know, thinking about my mom's experience at that first annual family weekend, you know, I walked away like, I need to get more involved. I need to participate and be active. And she was like, I'm exhausted and I don't want to talk about VHL for a year. Like, I don't want to think about it again. So, you know, we just have had really differing approaches to, you know, involvement and engagement in both the organization and community of VHL, as well as how we handle our care experiences. You know, I definitely make myself available to any of my family members that want to talk about it. If they need recommendations for where to seek their care, if they don't live locally, but I don't force it because I think those are all kind of personal care journeys. And, you know, you can kind of, the age old saying of like leading a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. So, you know, give them the information and be there to support. And that's kind of how I've approached it.
It's quite sensitive to be able to talk to family members, especially relatives, about their personal health journey and your personal health journey, because even though the disease might be the same, their response to it emotionally is going to be drastically different, right? And they'd be like, well, you're probably in a much better situation than I am, and you have no clue what I'm going through, right? And you don't want to create unnecessary tension. But having seen your mom go through, I'm curious, like, and having, you know, having you gone through it as well, have you seen any differences in attitudes because of the generation that you and your mom were born in, or difference in generation, right? Like, has there been, they might have been told something very different by their parents or by their medical community that is different than what you have been told. And then in general, the sentiment around chronic conditions has changed and evolved. So I'm curious, have you seen any attitude differences?
Yeah, I think, I don't know that I would like specific, my mom wasn't diagnosed until after me. So that's also a really interesting kind of generational difference I talk about a lot, is the fact that like my parents' generation, a lot of people of that age with VHL didn't know they had it until later in life, right? So, and or, you know, were diagnosed after their kid, potentially. So, you know, I think there's like a whole different set of situations and conversations that come out of that. And I say that like thinking about, you know, when they were choosing spouses or thinking about having kids and those types of conversations, as you start to, you know, become an adult, we're having to have those because we know we have this, right? So you could pass it on. You have to, you're signing a partner up for a little bit of the unknown from a health perspective with you and things like that. So there's a lot of interesting conversations that are happening across that young adult community and even, you know, people my age. I'm not that far out of the young adult, but a lot of those conversations are happening that didn't happen before. The other thing from like a like diagnosis perspective, and you probably even heard me when I heard it in some of the things that we were told when I was first diagnosed, right? Of like, basically like you're a sick kid. This is you, you're probably not going to live or be able to walk, you know, beyond the age of 15 or 16 years old. The diagnosis of VHL now, gosh, how old? I mean, I'm trying, 27-ish, 25 years ago was like, it felt like a death sentence, right? And now it's come so long, like so far. And those conversations at diagnosis, yeah, there's definitely things that are scary, right? Like there's definitely bad diagnosis of VHL. Like a lot of folks have ended up like their first manifestation is brain surgery. No brain surgery is going to be exciting to hear that you need to have, right? That's going to be a scary, scary thing. But the prognosis and the conversation around being diagnosed with VHL has changed so tremendously. And I do think that that has changed my mom's attitude with me even over the years. Like I said, she kind of wanted to keep me in this bubble. I moved from Pittsburgh to Chicago at 25 and she was like so not happy about it, like very not happy about it. And she was scared. I mean, for me to like be in this big city away from family, having to find a new care team, all of those things, right? And that disease is always in the back of her mind, right? It's always there. So As time has gone on, though, and she's seen me grow and she's seen the progress in the VHL community and heard other people's stories, I think that has allowed her to kind of settle down in some of her fear a little bit over the years, for sure. That's definitely something that I have seen. I would say, you know, kind of something interesting that I share when I think about like growing up and getting older. Probably up until 30, I didn't start thinking about saving for retirement because I didn't think I would live to retirement. So why would I save a chunk of money to not be able to use it later, right? Like those things that you think about when you have something like this and you're kind of that some of that fear is put in you of like you probably won't live to a certain age, right? And some of that has gone away. So now it's like you have to kind of like start building your life and living as if you're going to live. But those are like some of the unique and kind of weird things that people go through. But, you know, it's definitely changed over the years because of all of the progress. And I'll just say we have a research medical symposium every other year for our medical community and VHL researchers. And it was hosted at MD Anderson in 2018. And I attended, and I like remember sitting in that room, there was probably a little over 100 people. And I was like, I've never felt like so many people had my back before as like a patient living with this. And this is all that they were talking about. Like it was all clinicians and researchers talking about how to, you know, find a cure for VHL, how to make surveillance, how to make treatments, you know, better. And I met, he's currently on our board. His name's Dr. Othon Iliopoulos. He is a neurosurgeon at Mass General in Boston. And it's the first time I met him, and I'll never forget it. I told him, you know, I introduced myself, told him I was a patient, told him, you know, about my kind of patient journey and that I had the metastasis to the bone and things. And he's like, you're going to be fine. You're going to be okay. And it was the first doctor that ever said anything like that to me. And I think that like kind of in my head, like changed some of even the trajectory of the way I thought about my life. And that was just, you know, 6 years ago. So it's definitely been interesting to kind of see my own attitude, my mom's attitude really evolve over time, just given, you know, the different experiences that we've had and even being more plugged into the community. I really think that's helped, right? I never would have had that conversation with that doctor that told me I'm going to be okay had I not gotten involved.
This has been a great conversation. What's one thing you'd like our listeners to take away from today's discussion?
Yeah, I would say that one thing I probably regret is not being more open about my patient experiences sooner, especially working in healthcare. There was just some fear there. But when I made the decision to join the VHL board, I knew there was going to be, you know, a bio and information out there about me publicly, right? So I kind of leaned into that and really made the decision to be more open. And frankly, you know, my patient experience in my case actually makes me better at my job because I work in healthcare. And I just started to kind of lean into that. So I guess like my parting words would probably be don't be afraid to tell your story. I think it shows authenticity and you really never know who you're helping by opening up and being vulnerable and kind of sharing that piece of you. Because in the patient community, I think that's just so important for people to feel empowered and comfortable and safe to share that experience and in that perspective.
It's beautiful. I've always thought sharing is important, and the more I share, the more I get back. So I'm glad it resonates with you. Thank you so much for taking your time and talking to us and sharing your experience with us and with all of our listeners.
We hope you enjoyed today's conversation on Raising Rare. Please subscribe or follow us on your favorite podcast platform. We would love to get your feedback through ratings and reviews. And this week, tell someone that you think would be helped by our conversations on Raising Rare that they should be tuning in too.